The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California Time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in to this program, which really is going to be in the classroom format, although I did not promote this as a Space Show classroom program. I believe I will archive it as a classroom program. I'll tell you about the program and our three guests in just a minute. First, let me make some announcements. Number one, because we are doing the Space Show classroom format, your questions, whether you call us or send in an email, have got to be relevant to the discussion at hand. So typically, you know, you could ask anything. We could be doing a show about Mars and you could be asking about Venus, but not for today. So this is as if you're in a graduate school classroom. So your questions need to be relevant to what we're discussing if you want to be heard on the show today, and they need to be succinct. So we're make room for as many questions as possible, although we have a lot of material to cover. So, you know, unlimited questions will not take place on a classroom show. Okay, so that's one thing. The next thing is we have a hard stop time. So the show will have to stop at or before 105 minutes. So that's our regular 90-minute show plus an additional 15 minutes. So if you do want to get a question or a call in, you need to do it before then, because if you come in at the last minute, we won't have time to take your call or read your email on air. So that's another thing for you to consider for today. And we do have three guests with us, and two are on a cell phone and one is not. So do note that you'll hear differences in audio quality depending on who is speaking and when they're speaking. So for those of you who do want to call us today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient. We'll answer the phone and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You may be on hold for a minute or two, and you will hear all of the show through your telephone, so make sure you kill your computer speakers, and we'll get to you just as quickly as possible. For those of you listening at work or someplace where you can't really access or give us a call, the email account for today is drspace@thespaceshow.com. That is also our website address, thespaceshow.com. So we have a very detailed newsletter there, and you can access it. It's in the middle of the homepage. You can't possibly miss it. It is uploaded fresh every Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program. It has all of the comprehensive detail about the upcoming shows for the week, guest bios, and it's the only place where we have a future events section for the Space Show. And then do remember, if we have to modify the schedule for any given week or program date, we do it on the website newsletter. So make sure you check it from time to time to stay current, and the show you want to hear is the show you're going to hear. So then all of our programs are archived, and they do appear on the website and the blog, which is thespaceshow.wordpress.com. On the blog, you can exchange comments with other listeners. Many times the guests will exchange comments and respond to questions with you as well. There is a store on the website, upper part, called Space Show Gear. Do check it out, and hopefully you'll find some things of interest. The holiday season is coming up, so maybe for your favorite space cadet, getting them some Space Show logo items will be of interest to you. The most important button is support the space show. So remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with onegiantleapfoundation.org. And we exist because many of you are kind and generous and do support us. And it is your support that keeps us going on the air. Remember, if you pay federal taxes, you get a tax deduction because we are a nonprofit. And the same is true for those of you fortunate enough to pay California taxes, as we are a California public benefit corporation. If you have any questions, check us out at onegiantleapfoundation.org, which is our parent nonprofit website, or send an email to me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And if it's a technical question, I suggest you contact your person who guides you and helps you with taxes, because I'm anything but an accountant and cannot answer technical questions applicable to you and tax deductions or anything of that nature. Do remember that we are a trademark program and copyrighted. All of you are encouraged to share our shows with people. You can do that by either simply sending them the URL, or you could actually send someone the full show, but our shows are upwards of 40 megabytes, and it's not an easy email send. So either way, you're welcome to do that. We do have a few guidelines and rules. One, don't do anything commercial with our programs. Two, you are not to edit them or clip them or cut them in any way and upload things to YouTube or any other website, including your own. And number three, no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. Our full and detailed copyright statement is at the bottom of spaceshow.com website page, and also onegiantleapfoundation.org website page. It's going to be one of those mornings, I can already tell. Podcasting is through gigadial.net, and we're in iTunes and a lot of other places. And if you have any podcasting questions, be sure to get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. Check them out at their own website, www.swfound.org. And Tom Driggers, our life-saving broadcast engineer and website fixer-upper in the 11th and 12th hour. As I keep saying, Tom has been with us for almost the full 15 years of the Space Show program, and he has managed to keep us on the air when I thought for sure we would be canceling shows. So if you need emergency, life-saving, or regular engineering services or website fixes, Tom is a great guy, and his contact information is on the sponsors page on thespaceshow.com and onegiantleapfoundation.org. And that brings me to the show today, which, by the way, will not have a break, and this is to maximize our discussion time. So we're going to go the 105 minutes without a break. So for those of you that listen to many space show programs, you don't need an introduction for our three guests. But very briefly, Dan Adamo is back with us. And from 1979 to 2008, he was a contractor at JSC and involved with space mission trajectory simulation design and operations. Starting in 1990, he supported 60 space shuttle flights from Mission Control Flight Dynamic Officers Council. In 2018, he retired, and he pursues research and consulting and does an enormous job with educational outreach activities. Dr. John Juris is back with us. He's both a physicist and a medical researcher. He's been on the staff of the University of Wisconsin Medical School's Orthopedic Department. He has applied his business experience, for which he's been very successful, to his space work and his research and development activities. He's been an investor in New Space and other aerospace companies. He's a life member of the International Association of Military Flight Surgeon Pilots, an associate fellow of the Aerospace Medical Association, and an emeritus member of the Orthopedic Research Society, and a fellow of the the Old People's Society. How about that, John? His teaching and research activities involve his being an adjunct professor at the University of North Dakota Space Studies Department, and he's also an adjunct of biophysics and aviation at Rocky Mountain College. Dr. Jim Logan is back with us, and he has had numerous positions in his more than 20-year career at NASA, including chief of flight medicine, chief of medical operations. He served as mission control surgeon. wonder what that was, Deputy Crew Surgeon and Crew Surgeon for 25 Space Shuttle missions and Project Manager for the Space Station Medical Facility. He's a founding board member of American Telemedicine Association, and he's been a consultant for RAND and the Department of Defense. He's board certified as an aerospace medicine doctor. He's gotten NASA's Distinguished Speakers Award, and he has been to more than 13 countries to speak about space and medicine, including China. He was the provost of the International Space University in Strasbourg, France. He's been on the PBS, Canada, the History Channel, National Geographic, and many radio talk shows, including frequently on The Space Show. And he recently did a medical fellowship in undersea and hyperbaric medicine at Duke University Medical Center in North Carolina. Gentlemen, welcome to this Space Show program. And I would like to start out because, Jim, I know you attended the New Worlds Space Conference in Austin, which is a brand new advocacy organization. Tell us something about the conference and the organization from your perspective.
Yeah, David, I'd be happy to. First of all, let me tell you how glad I am to be back on the Space Show, especially with my favorite co-conspirators, Dan Adamo and Dr. John Juris. Good to be with you guys again. I did attend the New Worlds Conference and gave an invited presentation. It was in Austin, Texas, and as a naturalized Texan myself, Austin's always a great place to be. The venue was outstanding, and the topics were very good, and the speakers were also very good. Just to give you an idea of the kind of the range of speakers, Tom Mosier, who was my old boss at NASA during the early days of the space station program, gave a nice presentation on extended lunar architecture. Dr. John Lewis gave an outstanding presentation, as he usually does, as an update to asteroid mining. Let me also put in a plug for John's latest book, which is called Asteroid Mining 101. I've already ordered mine, and it's in the process of being delivered. I wish that I had had it with me so he could have autographed it, but it was great to see him again. There were two very good presentations on space solar power, believe it or not. Jim Caravella of Shackleton gave one, and another guy that unfortunately I cannot remember because of my advanced age also gave an excellent presentation on space solar power. In addition, there were a lot of really good student presentations, and I was especially happy about meeting a lot of the next generation of very energetic and entrepreneurial young people who are really starting to get excited about the future in space. The presentation that I gave was entitled Space Medicine, Reflections on the Intersection of Bioastronautics and Reality. As you might imagine, I kind of told it in my usual semi-opinionated way and expected to get a few rotten tomatoes, but it went over very well. The feedback that I got was that people appreciated kind of my frank assessments, and several people talked about how refreshing that kind of perspective is. On Friday, there were 450 high school kids that came. 60% of those had never attended such an event before, so that was nice to see. It was great to be around a lot of young people. I think next year the venue will again be in Austin. I think it'll be an Austin-based event. And I know next year from talking to Rick that he wants to move it in make it a more effective academic event like the original SSI conferences. But overall, I give it two thumbs up. I had a great time and also learned a lot.
So they didn't look at you as a Debbie Downer with your reality check on humans going into space?
No, you know, I was, especially the young people, I had actually a whole bevy of young people come up and tell me how much they appreciated, you know, my kind of direct comments. Usually when I go to these kinds of events and I give my standard evidence-based reality-based presentation, I hear some grumblings about people not being happy with my tone, but I didn't get any of that at this conference. In fact, if anything, I got a lot of positive feedback, and that was very refreshing for me, quite frankly. So this new generation of college students and graduate students and postdoc students, I think, are a different generation than the young people that I'm kind of used to doing battle with. So in that sense, I thought it was a very good experience. I enjoyed it very much, and I hope they invite me back for next year. And also, I'll add, David, that we were able to introduce some non-Texans into some of the best barbecue on the planet.
I hear they had a great party too. That's the main thing I've heard is they had an incredible get together or party the last night of the conference.
The parties were great. I didn't last too long at the parties because being a little bit senior, I was tired by the end of the day. But the music was great, and people seemed to have a real good time. So, and I enjoyed the music too.
Maybe the key is to get to the space cadets before they've been brainwashed by space cadet fever. So you had an opportunity to get them while they were still fresh, kind of like talking to elementary school students about science and physics and astronomy and stuff, and keeping that fresh in their mind so they don't lose it as they go through the program. Hopefully, if you keep refreshing them, if they come back next year, you'll be able to keep them having realistic attitudes rather than getting contaminated by the older cadets who are often, you know, la-la land most of the time.
I think that's an excellent perspective, David. I don't think I could have stated that any better than you did. I think you're absolutely right about that.
See, what I tell people, and we may want to talk about this later on if we have time, is that educating people is the absolute hardest and the most expensive thing to do. And the older and more entrenched someone is in a discipline or in a worldview or a personal view that doesn't have a lot of due diligence and fact-checking oversight, that's almost an impossibility to move someone from point A to point B, because they view the speaker as raining on their parade, and how can their parade be wrong? And that is the hardest thing that I've ever encountered on the space show, either with me or with all sorts of really well-qualified guests who didn't come on the show to educate, but just state their perspective or opinion, like from JPL or NASA or SpaceX or something else. And then they all pontificate with their ideas that override what the real people say the challenges and the ordeals are. So getting into the hands of people who are interested in this discipline while they're still fresh and haven't had a chance to, you know, be totally overwritten by what's possible in your dreams, I think is really, really important. And so maybe this conference will be a real good starting point for reaching some people in that capability, in that mode, because it is really difficult to educate people if they have not had that kind of fact-checking and oversight on their perspectives before. If they've just had the la-la land kind of space advocacy theories, you know, bombarding them, getting them to have a different worldview or to be more open-minded is really a challenge. I don't know if any of you want to comment on that or not.
I think the young people that I met there were much more into evidence than I'm used to dealing with. So these young people were really into what the data show and what the space flight experience has been, and what the implications are for that. And I had numerous conversations with many of them, and I never thought in the conversation that I was dealing with somebody's ideology, which is usually the sense that I have dealing with kind of, you know, the groups that you and I might term space cadets. I didn't get that feeling at all. These students were, you know, fresh enough in their interest and in their career that they were hungry for information. They were hungry for data. and their ideology hadn't set in real rigidly yet.
Well, speaking of, go ahead. Go ahead, John.
I think that may be a more general observation, Jim, than you might think, in that I've seen a lot of the younger people over the past 10 years trending toward better critical thinking and taking what they get in the media a lot more skeptically than those from a decade or 15 years ago. So hopefully that's a positive trend that they, the younger students now, college-level students, that is, are thinking a little more independently and a little more critical in their analysis than they used to be.
This is a good transition into our next topic, because nothing speaks to ideology more than humans going to Mars. So, listeners, I uploaded a commentary paper from Dan on the blog, which I hope you pulled down before the show, regarding NASA's Journey to Mars document. Going to Mars is just loaded with ideology, depending on who you speak to. So I think that's a good starting point. So, Dan, why take the time to comment on the Journey to Mars document from NASA?
Thanks, David, and it's a pleasure to be on. Let me reiterate Jim's words. The motivation in doing this was sort of twofold. I think this document, Journey to Mars, it's called JTM for shorthand, the document has a lot of value because it tries to explain and succeeds in no small measure, explaining the journey's three phases, which are Earth-reliant, where we are right now in low Earth orbit with ISS, and then we'll transition to a proving ground in cislunar space, where we will learn, hopefully, how to shield ourselves against radiation, work more independently of mission control and Earth-bound logistics, and just in general transition to interplanetary space, which is called the Earth independent phase. And that, of course, would encompass missions to Mars, whether in orbit or on the surface. And so the document succeeds there, but it fails to a great degree in fleshing out the details. And that's what really motivated this this commentary, this essay, because I think there's a lot of critical thinking that can be brought to bear on what this document is telling us and where it sort of departs from reality.
Where it departs from reality, are we talking about issues on the margins, or are we talking about some major significant departures?
Well, I think it's major because there's a lot of talk going around now about exploring and pioneering, and there's even legislation pending in Congress, which may or may not actually be voted on into law, that says NASA ought to pioneer space. I may be oversimplifying it, but NASA itself gave what I thought was a very appropriate distinction between exploring and pioneering in a 2014 paper that I quote from in my essay. Quote, "Explorers go with the intent of returning to tell their story and point the way for future forays. Pioneers go with the intent to establish a permanent presence." So I'm always drawing the analogy between that, end quote, by the way. I'm always drawing the analogy between exploration and Lewis and Clark opening up the Northwest United States. And then the pioneers came afterward. In fact, they even met some of the initial pioneers on the way back from the Pacific Northwest. Fur trappers pushing their way up the Missouri River to create a viable business. These pioneers may not have stayed permanently, but those that followed them certainly did. So when we talk about NASA pioneering in space, first of all, we need an act of Congress because the Space Act of 1958 does not, nowhere in that Space Act is the word pioneer or any of its derivatives does it appear. Exploring does. That appears seven times in that document. So we have a real disconnect when this document's subtitle is Pioneering Next Steps in Space Exploration. It's just a contradiction in terms, and it's nonsense to say that you pioneer before you explore. In effect, that's what it's implying. And the word pioneering is just really misused throughout the document, so that you think NASA is going to start settling Mars, and there's several points a permanent presence, a permanent human presence on Mars is advocated, and that's just a huge difficulty if you're talking about permanent presence the way we think of it in the ISS or at bases in Antarctica. Where you have like a handover, you know, the off-going crew hands over to the oncoming crew face-to-face, and then the takeover is, you know, this may last a couple weeks while they brief each other, and then the off-going crew heads back to civilization. Well, on Mars, you can't really do that. If the oncoming crew blasts off for Mars, they can't arrive at Mars before the off-going crew needs to leave. So if they really want to meet face-to-face and establish that permanent presence that we always worry about on ISS, it would be a tremendous disappointment if we had to evacuate ISS for even 5 minutes. We want a continuous human presence there. Well, to do it on Mars is hugely difficult because you then have to have two crews on Mars for about 500 days, and that doubles the logistics burden. Also makes the because the crew has to stay there 500 days longer than they otherwise would have. They'll be away from Earth for about 4.8 years. So you hear these talks about crews being away from the Earth almost 3 years under a conventional mission where you don't worry about handovers. It gets extended to 4.8 years if you try to have continuous human presence on Mars.
Well, what if they don't come back and it's just one way to Mars with the crews and you keep building up more and more people on Mars with each blast off from Earth like a lot of the private organizations advocate and want to do?
And what we see there is, you know, an even greater logistics burden. And, you know, Mars One, some of the criticism levied at Mars One really comes to a peak where you have to ship so many supplies for spare parts, et cetera, because they don't have manufacturing facilities there right away. And yet they're building up this population that demands more and more system support and more spare parts to keep those systems running. And a critical, you know, systems that the system is just going to break under its own weight. And it leads me to the real fundamental question is, why are we doing this? You know, it's pretty obvious what we were doing when we pioneered the United States. We had business models that were viable. They returned on investment. Pioneers were risking life and limb, but they could raise crops, livestock, sell it, trap beaver, whatever your thing was, and make a profit. Well, what's the business model on Mars? We just don't have one. And until we do, we're crazy to talk about pioneering. Exploration, fine. And in fact, exploration may lead to a viable business model that supports pioneering. But to call NASA a pioneering agency is just literally incorrect, legally incorrect. And then I really think that if Congress is going to go and say, okay, NASA, we're going to heap pioneering on your plate, which is already over full, I think everyone would agree, and we're not going to give you any extra money. I mean, we know from the last incarnation of the Augustine Commission in 2009, you need $3 $1,000 a year extra in 2009 dollars to just explore with humans out away from low Earth orbit, whether it's the moon, Mars, whatever. If you're going to pioneer as well, you're talking about huge burdens of logistics, another order of magnitude. And so I wouldn't think it at all out of line to say if you need $3 billion to explore out of low Earth orbit, you probably need something like $30 billion a year to pioneer out of low Earth orbit. It's just an insane concept, and I just really wish NASA would let the politics play itself out. Hopefully reason will prevail.
There will be space show listeners who say, of course NASA can't do this. That's why the private sector is going to get to Mars first. And you see all sorts of articles appearing how the private sector will go to Mars before NASA. So what about pioneering by the private sector? They would have different constraints than what NASA would have.
And more power to them. If they can pull that off technically, just exploring, my hat's off to them. Because sending humans just into Mars orbit, let alone under the surface, even one way, is quite an accomplishment. But again, if this is going to be more than just a stunt, if it's going to be more than Apollo 2.0 over and done with after a few missions, and you're really going to pioneer, where's the business model that supports that? Why are people on Mars able to turn a profit? Because they consume billions, probably tens of billions, just getting there. And then if you want them to stay there and pioneer, that's even more than tens of billions. You're probably talking hundreds of billions. The logistics, unless we invent warp drive, the costs for that are just overwhelming. Why are you there, and how do you turn that profit that justifies your existence on Mars? That's my question.
Okay, so another question for you guys would be, today we don't have the technologies and the answers to a lot of the human factors, medical challenges for humans going beyond low Earth orbit. So is it wise to be working on developing and researching these fields now for an ultimate Mars trip down the road? And what would it take to be ready to go to Mars? I mean, at what point do you say we've researched enough, we have enough answers? Who wants to tackle that?
Let the medical guys take over for me for a while here.
Well, I would say that we need to get better answers to the issues related to radiation and microgravity before we get too involved in planning any kind of missions in deep space. The problem with radiation is, in my opinion, greatly underestimated by many of the people who are proponents of human spaceflight. That doesn't mean that it's a showstopper necessarily, but it is a major item of concern. The big thing that came along a couple of years ago about that was the Mars Science Lab, which had some radiation exposure data that was collected on the way to Mars, and the average dose rates that were encountered were about a dozen times higher than just doubling the typical space shuttle exposure rates. The space shuttle exposure rates were somewhere on the order of maybe 1/15th of a millisievert per day as a very rough average. You double that because you're away from the Earth shielding effect because of the geometry of the shielding. So that gets you up to somewhere around 1/6th of a millisievert per day. But that, of course, is conservative because you're also ignoring the effects of the Earth's protective magnetic field on the exposure limits there. The Mars Science Lab data averaged about 1.8 millisieverts a day. And if you take a typical low-energy 9-month one-way trip time, That ends up coming out to be on the order of 0.4 to half of a sievert just during the trip. And if you're talking about a zero-time stay on Mars with a flyby and free return, then you're looking at maybe 0.8 of a sievert to 1 sievert. And at the same time, NASA has set up what's called a 3% REID, or additional risk of death from radiation exposure. And those limits that are currently in place suggest that the career limits would be exceeded unless male astronauts taking one of those trips is are older than 45 years of age, and females are limited to those over 50 years of age. And that's not counting the possibility of flares intersecting the spacecraft or the stay time on Mars accumulating additional radiation exposure. Now, people can argue about the models, and certainly that's valid because the human exposure data and response data are very, very squishy at present. So they need to be tightened up quite a bit before you can really start talking about what's involved on the trip to and from Mars. And the same holds true for microgravity. So it seems to me that unless these issues are addressed, talking about sending humans to Mars is more or less hand-waving.
So,
I might also mention that from a historic standpoint, when people like, for example, the Germans in 1920s and 30s and even 40s were talking about human spaceflight in the future, they were talking about technical possibilities, and they gave some fairly plausible scenarios involving how one might be able to get humans to the moon and so on. But the technology started limiting the actual planning process to the point where those initial scenarios bore absolutely no resemblance to what finally took place in going to the moon. And I would postulate that the same thing would hold true for Mars.
So at what point do you say we have enough research to plan the mission to Mars, or do you start planning the mission to Mars while simultaneously trying to answer the research questions you've been talking about?
Well, my take would be that you can start thinking about various scenarios that would allow one to get to Mars, but you can't really do a lot of extremely specific planning for a single mission configuration until you get answers to the kinds of questions I'm posing. So, for example, right now, chemical propulsion to Mars implies maybe, and this is a back-of-the-envelope kind of thing, a 9-month trip to Mars, maybe a 9-month trip back, give or take, plus a stay time that Dan can address. So what happens if you introduce nuclear thermal propulsion? For example, the Aquarius-type program that Jim and Dan have talked about that would allow a shortened trip time. It gives you much better mass ratios that are required to get to the vicinity of Mars and back. And so all of your, if you then accept the idea of nuclear thermal propulsion, all of the scenario planning for chemical propulsion is gone. So it just seems to me that you have to kind of fold that in, but you have to clearly understand that you're laying out potential scenarios rather than specific plans.
So if you take that approach, how can you meet a proposed timeline, which is out there for early 2030?
That depends on how fast you get some of the answers to the human factors issues that I've talked about. And by the way, I'd mention one more, is long-term life support with low-maintenance life support systems, which the space station is not.
Yeah, but nobody.
And if you're going to Mars, you need to have a good long-term life support system.
But nobody seems to be working to get these answers that you're talking about, and, unless Jim knows of other research projects or things that are trying to get answers to these questions. I mean, or maybe Dan knows about them. So if the if they're not being worked on under the assumption that they're not being seriously worked on, I ask the question again, how do you take seriously a NASA roadmap to Mars for the early 2030s?
I would say the human race is just marching in place.
So you don't take it seriously?
No.
Jim or Dan, do you... I mean, is it realistic? Assuming John is correct, and we need this information, is it realistic to think that in 15-plus years, we're going to be able to fly a human mission to Mars?
Well, I think it's certainly possible, but I think you can start doing it simultaneously. You can decide on a timeline, but then the timeline really requires that you do some of this work. A lot of it has to do with the mission architecture. I know Dan and I have sent some emails back and forth, and there are estimates of a kind of a standard Mars mission that comes up with a total radiation dose of about one sievert to maybe 1.2 sieverts.
Right.
But if you could assume just one operational requirement, which is what Dan and I refer to as radiation protection level 100. In other words, 100% of Earth radiation protection at the destination, you end up with a mission that has only 43% of that original total mission dose. Now, that's a very doable mission, but it has a lot of implications when you're planning the mission.
Yeah, it starts to get it. Really challenging pre-emplacement techniques, probably using autonomous telerobotics.
Is any
where you would vary your habitat in advance of the crew arriving using smart robots, and that is pushing the technology a little bit.
Are we going in that direction?
It's interesting. Yep. When I started circulating my essay around NASA, I went to some high places and I got some very interesting feedback. And when, at several points where I started criticizing the notion that you would send astronauts out in EVA garb with virtually no radiation shielding on daily EVAs, and they would come back to a poorly shielded habitat that's above the surface. The reaction was, yeah, we realize that everyone's going to get fried. We need to start looking at subsurface habitat. So the stuff is out there, but then the documentation doesn't reflect that awareness. You know, this document I wrote commentary on talks about these kinds of concepts with pretty little pictures and everything.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say you'll know that NASA is serious about some of these issues when you stop seeing PowerPoint presentations looking at small pressurized rovers on Mars and astronauts in spacesuits with picks and shovels on the Mars surface. I mean, once you stop seeing that, then you'll realize that maybe the agency is serious about some of these problems. But the fact that that hasn't stopped indicates to me that the agency is, there may be individual people that are enlightened, but as an organization, it's still clueless about what the real issues are and how to go about solving these issues. Let me state the same thing for exposure to microgravity, too. I mean, I think you can use the following as a litmus test. I think NASA should be considered serious about pioneering Mars in the way that Dan has defined the terms when it sets up a comprehensive, systemic, ongoing program to determine a feasible operational gravity prescription. And by gravity prescription, I mean the dose, the frequency, and the side effects for Mars operations. And that includes transit. It includes loitering around the Mars system, that is Phobos, Deimos, and Mars orbit, and also the surface operations. But until I see some kind of commitment and some kind of funding from the agency to really do that, my conclusion is either the agency doesn't understand what the real issues are, or they have no intention of solving this problem before they send a crew to Mars. And if it's the latter rather than the former, then my conclusion is that all this Mars scenario stuff from the agency right now is quite frankly just simply a full employment program for NASA aerospace engineers.
Do we need a gravity prescription to do cislunar in the moon?
We may, depending on the durations that you're talking about. I mean, if 0.38G doesn't help the Martian gravity, then 1/6G sure isn't going to help. But the prescription could be fairly easy. For instance, there was the short arm centrifuge that was built down at University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. It was built as a countermeasure. It generated a longitudinal loading of 1G at the heart and 2.5Gs at the feet. And there was a study published in the Journal of Applied Physiology by Simons et al. In 2009 that looked at a prescription of basically 1 hour of artificial gravity daily during a 21-day, 6-degree head-down bed rest study. And, of course, those kinds of bed rest studies are the best Earth-based analog we have to look at the effects of weightlessness. They looked at a number of things, and they found that in one parameter, what's called mixed muscle fractional synthesis, which is an index of protein breakdown, that the experimental group got a 48.5% reduction the control group got a 48.5% reduction from the experimental group. Now, that generates a p-factor of 0.001. So it initially appeared that 1 hour of artificial gravity maintained the rate of protein synthesis in some of these lower extremities muscles and could be an effective countermeasure. But to my knowledge, there have been no follow-up studies, and I'm not sure anything more has been done on the short-arm centrifuge, which I think is almost criminal.
A couple of...
I'd like to jump in here. The terminology I'm using is maybe slightly different, but, John talked about microgravity. Jim's talking about the gravity prescription, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the distinction between microgravity, which, NASA arguably knows a little bit about microgravity and how to mitigate its effects, even if they don't have to use direct methods like a centrifuge. But when it comes to reduced gravity, 38% of Earth gravity on Mars, we're totally ignorant. We might have some data that needs massaging from ground-based analogs and all that, but we're still ignorant, truly, about that. And it really speaks very shockingly to the NASA organization, because at least the organization I grew up in at NASA, Mission Operations, you took risks, but they were calculated risks. So if you're going to plan a mission to Mars where you're going to put people there 500 days in an environment you haven't studied yet, you better study it before you launch them. Then you might be in a position to take a calculated risk sending them into that environment with some indication that they might survive without special measures, or you implement those special measures. But what we're doing instead is sink or swim. There is no plan to study 38% Earth gravity effects on humans before we actually send them into that environment for either 500 days or they might have a possible bailout where they could go back into Mars orbit for some balance of that 500 days before they initiate their return to Earth. But then they're talking about microgravity, so they better have some kind of effective countermeasures for that. And you know, that's why this Aquarius concept that we keep mentioning uses an onboard centrifuge. I know of only one other interplanetary transport design that uses that, that's, you know, been seriously engineered, you know, not talking about Hermes on the Martian or something like that. But, you know, when I saw the Hermes on the motion picture of the Martian, I couldn't help but whisper to myself, exclaiming, now that's a spacecraft, because it's got a centrifuge on it, sort of like the Discovery did on 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's a spacecraft. And it's one you don't throw away either.
Let's postulate one extreme in the envelope, and that is, let's assume that by some combination of exercise and pharmaceutical interventions that microgravity could be tolerated in an acceptable way for the full mission time. Then it's reasonable to assume that if some of that time is at 38%, of a G, that that's going to be tolerable as well. But that may or may not be the case, and hopefully the mission that's in place right now with Kelly on the space station will give some indication of just how good or how bad the issue of microgravity exposure long-term may be. And Jim, you might want to comment on that.
Well, first of all, a sample size of one doesn't mean anything
limited
in biology or medicine. So it doesn't matter what they find out for Scott Kelly. It's completely insufficient. And the problem is, John, I mean, I know that you're well aware of that, but the problem is the agency will promote that just like they promoted flying John Glenn on the shuttle was going to answer all their questions about aging in
right.
micro-G, which was clearly not the case. In fact, that statement is ultimately misleading. So my concern is that Scott Kelly comes back, he survives, he does pretty well, no telling what his bones look like. And we know that you the trabecular bone that you lose, you really don't get back. It's an analog of postmenopausal osteoporosis. So, you know, he's going to come back, and he's going to smile for the cameras, and the engineers and the agency and the decision makers are going to say, see, this is no big deal. This microgravity stuff is no big deal. And nothing is further from the truth.
Well, also, Kelly's a fairly young guy, and if you're postulating limiting the flight, for example, under the Reed limits to women over 50 or men over the age of 45, by the time they get back, the superimposed bone loss may cause real problems for them as they subsequently age in the terrestrial environment.
So I have a question for you guys. I'm going to move the topic a little bit. About maybe 3 or 4 months ago, I did a show with Dr. Charles Limone, or Limoni, I think is how you pronounce his name, from UC Irvine, who postulated cognitive changes among the astronauts and people going to space for longer periods of time based on, I believe, rodent studies. Based upon the effect of radiation. So nobody today has talked about cognitive and awareness changes as a result of the space environment. And I don't know that NASA is talking about that as a big issue for going to Mars or not. I don't get to read all of the literature on this. But how big a issue is cognitive damage from the space environment?
Well, I think anytime you're dealing with cognitive decline, that's a huge issue for long duration space missions. People have to realize
and for colonization or pioneering.
Say again, John.
And for pioneering.
So does that mean you don't do it, or is there a mitigation? Can you take medicine to subvert the decline? I mean, how do you address that one?
I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that question, David.
Jim, are there medicines or supplements that you can take?
No. The obvious answer, and it's an answer that the engineers are loath to hear, but it's the answer nonetheless, and that is you have to minimize your total radiation dosage. So radiation protection is the answer.
That adds mass.
I was going to say mass and cost to the mission.
Yes, it does. But you can also look at it from an operational perspective, as I've talked about previously. But you are going to have to provide increased radiation protection some way. Now, when Dan and I came up with the Aquarius concept, that was one idea of how you could go about it to minimize your total radiation dose. And we were able to cut the total radiation dose on a Mars system mission by more than one half by looking at some things that are doable. So, yes, I realize that the engineers will always say, well, wait a minute, that increases mass. But the argument that I always give them is, look, folks, this is just an inconvenient truth. I mean, as far as I know, I don't remember any life science person complaining that escape velocity was inconvenient. I mean, it was just part of reality. You had to overcome escape velocity to put anything in orbit. And in the same vein, you're going to have to mitigate total radiation exposure, or you're not going to be able to do anything successfully. You know, we have to remember that the read values, the risk of exposure-induced death, the 3% read is only pegged to one outcome, and that outcome is death by cancer that you got because of your operational exposure. So there's no read that's pegged to cognitive decline, even though we know that it does exist.
I'm wondering if it's a good time to talk about an Aviation Week article I just read, originally published in September 7th issue this year. It says that NASA's got a roadmap toward possible nuclear rocket flight and a demo. And the lead center is Marshall. And they're if they got a go-ahead, they could be running a 7,500-pound thrust or a 16,700-pound thrust engine for flight tests on the ground in 2022 to 2024. That sort of gives you at least one milestone on the way to Mars. That's a go-ahead now, get you some ground testing in 2022 with nuclear thermal. One of the interesting things they are thinking of doing, they want to do a lunar flyby as an initial flight test, but they're going to use liquid hydrogen as propellant, which I'm sort of disappointed in. I'd rather see them work on water. They think they can get something out to Mars with humans on board, and then they would refuel it with liquid hydrogen pre-emplaced in Mars orbit, which sounds an awful lot like Aquarius, except that...
Dan?
Water. Yeah?
A question on that is, assuming that you could do a ground test of one of those motors, which essentially is resurrecting some 50-year-old technology, by the way, in 2022, what's that do to getting humans to Mars by 2030? Because that seems like an awfully short timeline to freeze your technology in 2022 and still get humans to Mars by 2030.
Yeah, well, I think they may be working more toward 2040. The decade of the U.S. space policy that sort of justifies all this work about getting humans to Mars, it only advocates putting humans in Mars orbit, doesn't say anything about the surface, and then says in the 2030s. So you could stretch that to 2039 somewhere. You might still be on a path to doing that, but anyone who thinks they can do it on a flat budget is insane. That's just insane. The $3 billion a year comes into play. Somewhere late this decade or early in the 2020s, you need $3 billion a year more for NASA to get this to happen. Of course, some people say Elon Musk will wave a magic wand and just do it on his own. But I'm waiting to see it.
That brings up another broad question, and that is, let's assume that the various pressures associated with national debt and the like cause interest rates to rise a little bit. What's that do to the affordability of that extra $3 billion a year?
It's going to inflate. And, of course, interest rates have nowhere to go but up from this point.
David?
Well, I mean, I've been talking...
You want to weigh in on that?
I've been talking about this for months, and usually I get dismissed, but the Fed says they're going to start raising interest rates. And whether they start this year or next year, I don't have a crystal ball on that. But we're at a near zero rate right now, and everybody says, look, the NASA budget is so insignificant, it's half of 1%, who cares, and all that. But I don't believe that that's a valid argument, because with a national debt of near $20 trillion, $19 trillion or something like that, if they start evolving interest rates, and let's say, you know, they go to 1%, 2%, and they, you know, over several years, they get back to where interest rates have usually been hovering, which is in the neighborhood of around 5% on government bonds, you're talking about 5% on $20+ trillion. And I don't see how the discretionary items are going to fare very well, especially if you want to do things and add to it. And, yeah, the NASA budget is really tiny, but it still is consuming a lot of money. And where are they going to get the money to pay the interest on the national debt? So, you know, some of the items in the budget are fixed, you know, like the Social Security entitlements and stuff, and you can't really do a whole lot about that. But the discretionary items, you know, they can do something with. They can raise taxes, but as most people know, you could tax everybody 100%, and you still wouldn't, you know, make a dent in either retiring the national debt or covering the interest if we had a real interest rate. So I think it's a real risk for a lot of things that the government does on the discretionary side, including space. And I don't think the argument that NASA's budget is so tiny and it'll just squeak under the covers and under the detection, I don't think that's valid. I think that there'll be a lot of things that are sacrificed for rising interest rates and the national debt, because I don't think they'll allow us to default on our national debt. I think it's a real nightmare scenario down the road that we may likely see fulfilled, unless they are willing to keep interest rates artificially low like they're doing right now. I don't know.
Well, for the sake of just looking at numbers, David, if you're talking about roughly $20 trillion, 5% of that's $1 trillion, the NASA annual per year just for interest. And that would be in addition to whatever is going on now, because the interest rates are near zero. So the NASA budget's what? Roughly, again, very roughly, $20 billion a year?
$18 billion.
Which is 1/50th or 2% of that trillion?
Yeah, $18 to $19 billion a year. So it's 1/2 of 1%.
So it's on the order of 2% of that $1 trillion. So by zeroing out the NASA budget, they get all the way to covering 2% of that additional debt load from interest. What else ends up being cut to try to get to that?
Well, I don't think they'd zero out the full NASA budget. I think it would be flat at some level, or possibly some reduced level. I don't think they would destroy the NASA program but I don't think you'd see a lot of future growth in it, and probably a lot of other programs too. What we need is
something like 10% growth to do the serious interplanetary human spaceflight.
Well, I don't know how you're going to get there with that. Do you have a way to get 10% growth?
No, I certainly don't. That's why I'm very, very skeptical about anybody's plan that says we're going to get to Mars faster, better, cheaper. And that's what we've been hearing for the last year, almost nonstop. It's incessant. And I wish people would be more realistic instead of, positive thinking has its place, but when it becomes delusional, I just start to scratch my head. Why are we doing this to ourselves? We'll kill somebody.
Well, the other side of it is they hope to lay off a lot of the cost, and we haven't really talked about this, with international cooperation and making the projects international, including Mars, so that other countries will, will share in the financial burden of it. But you can see what's happening to economies all around the world. We're not the only ones under pressure. And I might add that while I have no crystal balls here, but I do stay current with the news, given the issues of terrorism that are affecting the world and affecting world governments, and the increased budgets that are going to be needed for Homeland Security, the FBI, and stuff like that. And I don't think anybody can deny that there's going to be additional funds going into these groups, regardless of where our budget is and what we're doing. And I don't think people are going to say, let's not properly fund these groups and instead let's go to Mars. I mean, maybe there'll be space cadets that want to do that. But I think that for the West in general, in the industrialized world, there are going to be increasing expenses, significant expenses, to deal with national and global security that we have not faced before. And I think this is going to weigh in heavily, especially if interest rates start rising, because the cost of that money going into Homeland Security, for the lack of a better word, is going to be really costly. And I'm skeptical, too, that unless there is a way to pay for these expanded programs down the road, I think we may see a long period of kind of flat budget and status quo, and a lot of missed opportunity. I hope that doesn't happen. I'd like to think that my conservatism here is ill-founded and won't come to pass. But there's going to be a lot of pressures on how we spend our money, and I don't know that Mars and space are going to be top priorities. Any thoughts from you guys?
The big challenge isn't so much technical as it is the motivation, the rationale for it. Why are we taking these risks?
Well, let's address that. Why are we
going to Mars?
Maybe someone will call the show and answer it. What is the benefit for going to Mars? Now, I know exploration is a big benefit, and people say because it's there and it pushes the envelope and we learn from it. But if we're going to go pioneering to Mars, what is the benefit for that? And especially, what is the benefit of the public sector in doing that? Again, if private parties think that they can do it and they want to spend their money that way, I am totally supportive of it. I think go do it and Godspeed, and I hope you can do it well. I think it's another issue for the public sector. So what are those rationales and benefits? Maybe someone will phone in with a group of them, or maybe one of you can tell us the why are we doing it, or the rationale. There are no business models that I know of. And to say that we can get entertainment value and things like that, I think are really a stretch, because, you get to make a movie, of the mission to Mars and the 9-month mission and this and that and the other and all of that. I don't think that you can sell the movie rights and the entertainment and even make a dent in the cost of the mission. And we do have...
Even if it's a blockbuster.
We do, and
David, as we've talked about before, fine if you're a private concern and want to go off to Mars, but somebody in the federal government ought to make it really, really clear to those folks, if they are allowed to do this, and they should be, that they shouldn't expect rescue. We can't afford it.
We have a caller, so let's see what our caller wants to say to us. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please, and thank you for your call.
This is John Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Listen to all this, and you were asking for what the rationale is. I think we have to recall that the rationale was because, first of all, we had a program to do something much more modest and far more feasible, the return to the moon, which was canceled by the current administration, and they pretty much said, as a policy or position, that moon is not interesting, been there, done that, and therefore NASA, searching for some reason to justify their existence in the exploration budget, said Mars. And since I think everybody realized that it's in the nose of the people on this panel do, you've made the case pretty clear, that's not likely to happen during that eight-year period that they were concerned about. So the result is where we are today.
Do you think there's a rationale for going to Mars? Is there a business case? Or, if we are under economic duress, what do you say? I mean, hopefully we won't be, but if that scenario plays out, what do you think?
Well, my personal opinion is that we should develop our capabilities, Earth to orbit and Earth to moon, first. I mean, I think that at the present time, right at this minute, we don't even have the existing national capability to put a person in orbit right now safely. I mean, obviously we could have it shortly with commercial crew in a couple of years or whatever, but the point is, and now we're talking about Mars with all the tremendous difficulties in human factors, propulsion technologies, and particularly costs. It just seems to me to be kind of a distraction that's being used to play kind of a rope-a-dope game on the public here.
Guys, do you want to comment or talk to John about any of this?
I'll certainly jump in. Okay, you go first.
Okay. You got your two approaches to justify going to Mars. One is pioneering, which we're really groping around for, and the other is exploring. And if anything, if you're interested in Mars exploration, if anything, there's the most compelling rationale we have regarding that is not to put humans on Mars, because there may be extant life there. There's flowing water on the surface under the right conditions. We should not be putting humans with their effluent and other excreta on Mars, because we may destroy what we're trying to study before we can. So to me, that's the most compelling argument about Mars exploration, why we should not put humans on Mars.
Well, certainly, and we've talked about this before, Dan and Jim. You can have teleoperational systems on the surface of Mars with humans close to Mars, as either in Mars orbit or on one of the moons.
Yeah,
so maybe that's
powerful.
A possibility. But I fear that maybe all of this talk about sending humans to Mars in the near term would be like asking Queen Isabella to forget about sending those boats west. Let's just go for the moon. It's just not the right time and not the right level of technology to support it.
Jim, do you have a comment?
Well, I mean, as usual, I have to agree with John and Dan. I don't see any compelling argument to put humans on Mars right now. I see a compelling argument to explore Mars, but that can be done from Deimos or Mars orbit or wherever. I mean, I'm all for doing a forward-deployed humans-in-the-loop, low-latency time tele-exploration. I think you can justify that. But in terms of human boots on the ground, why? I've never been convinced that there's a viable argument for doing that, but let me also add, it doesn't matter whether there's a viable argument for doing that. We can't do that. We can't do it. Putting humans on Mars today with current technology is a bridge too far. So we don't have to worry that NASA is going to put astronauts on the surface of Mars for 500 days. And the reason we don't have to worry about it is because they can't do it.
And they shouldn't, as any astrobiologist would argue. They shouldn't put people on Mars. We know a lot
and
more.
I completely agree with that.
So if Bob Zubrin was on the show, there'd be a war declared right now. So what would you change what you say to Bob? Because he's very, very good at generating compelling reasons and data. I mean, I would not dismiss him at all.
Yeah, this sounds like Jurassic Park all over again. You know, Bob has thought really hard about how can we do it, but I'm not sure he's thought about should we.
Well, he gives a rationale for doing it all the time and you know, supports.
All ears.
I mean, you've
I'm
heard,
all ears.
You've heard him on the space show. I know you disagree with him, but he believes that this is what humans need to do to keep a society fresh and to keep it expanding and growing and not to be stale and to ultimately turn inward and demise from lack of reaching out and doing outreach and doing these things that keep it fresh and on the cutting edge.
But and here's the big but, why Mars? Why not 1999 AO10 or some other near-Earth object that we study as much as Mars? We might find it's a much more compelling destination and much more accessible, too.
Well, I think...
Yeah, David?
Go ahead.
Well, you know, I would never dismiss Bob Zubrin. I think he's a very intelligent guy, and I agree with his arguments. But Dan raised the salient point, and that is the surface of Mars is not the place to try to get human beings off the planet. We all agree that we have to do that. There's no debate there. We all agree that's the ultimate human destiny if we survive long enough. But the surface of Mars is not the place to do that. So that's the part of his argument that I have a problem with. And it doesn't matter whether I agree with him that that's the place to do it or not. My point is that currently, with existing technology, we can't do that.
Right.
We don't have the technology to do that.
No, correct. But he says, and I think he's a little aggressive here, but you know, he believes that if we started on it today, we could be on Mars in 10 years. So I think a lot of people could argue that with him, both on the human factors, medical side, as well as the technology side. But I think Mars is considered the ultimate human destination, although believe it or not, I am seeing 20% of my email from the show coming in that we should, you'll love this, we should forego Mars, and where we should go for pioneering is Venus and the upper atmosphere of Venus. And in fact, I just as the show was starting this morning, unrelated to the show, it wasn't an email relevant to the show at all, I got another email about... should we colonize Venus instead of Mars? So this is a YouTube video that somebody has created. And so Venus is actually gaining on Mars. I'm not kidding you. This is from PBS Digital Studios. I just pulled it up because I didn't do it. PBS Space Time, whoever the heck that is. But 20% of my mail now is I'm going to be compelled. I've been blowing off a couple of listeners who wanted me to do a Venus show for a long time because I think it's total BS. But I've got 20% of my mail now is information coming in about, pioneering Venus.
And my reaction to that is certainly... it's as arguable as pioneering Mars. For one thing, although the view through a sulfuric acid cloud deck may not be very enjoyable or aesthetic, neither is the view of Mars
through CCTV because you have to bury yourself from the radiation. At least in the atmosphere of Venus, you have radiation protection equivalent to Earth's sea level if you're at one atmosphere pressure, which I think is something like 50 kilometers up. And you also have gravity that's about only 10% different from Earth's. So it's very arguable that Venus is a better choice than Mars for a human destination and pioneering. I just, again, don't know the business case.
I think Barbarella might be there.
The one thing, David, the one thing Venus doesn't have is it doesn't have resources. So you got a huge logistic nightmare if you're going to try to establish any kind of presence in the atmosphere of Venus, because you have a huge gravity well to deal with, and there are no resources there. I mean, at least on Mars, there are some resources, as on the Moon. But floating in the atmosphere of Venus, there are no resources there, even though it does solve your microgravity problem, and it might go a long way to solve your radiation problem.
Wouldn't asteroids make more
adding
sense
in
to
the
Venus?
The sulfuric acid problem.
John, do you have any more questions, or I'll clear the line?
Two things, and I'll get out real quick. I just want to make that my point is not long-term anti-Mars. It's just I don't think it should be the next step from where we are right now. And the second thing is I'll ask a question, leave. Wouldn't asteroids make more sense than Venus? And I'll leave now.
All right. Thanks, John. I don't know. Does anyone want to comment on his asteroid comment? I got another.
Well, I think the answer to that question is
earlier. What he said earlier was that, you know, Mars is not the next step, and I think NASA agrees with him. We need the proving ground out there in cislunar space before we even tackle near-Earth objects in their native orbits.
So I want to get to that because I got an email question I'm going to ask you first, but one of the issues would be, can we successfully use SLS and Orion, for example, for cislunar and the moon, or are we going to be looking at Falcon Heavy? But this is from Joe in Houston, and maybe you guys can address this really quickly. He wants each of you to comment on this, but, you know, one of you can comment on it, and that's fine. We don't need to have the three of you say the same thing. Is it right? Please ask each guest what they believe is step one in terms of taking actions to get people to Mars. So we've already kind of talked about that with cislunar and moon. But is it right, tempting paper, laying out the ideal plan that no one with real money will ever read? Or is it voting for the politician that likes space the most and hoping for the best? Is it ignoring enormous negatives and focusing only on the positives? Is it just doing it on your own? My step one is collect more money than I can imagine and then multiply it by 10. So does anyone want to address the first step that Joe suggests? I don't think any of you suggest, nor do I, the 1, 2, 3, the four items he listed, kind of tongue-in-cheek, I think, like writing papers or voting for this or that politician or something like that. The first step is proving out technologies, which to me is returning to the moon and developing a cislunar economy, which I think there's a hard business case to make for that, too, right now.
There is, but even independent of that, NASA has, I think, adequate funding, even with a flat budget, to get humans back to cislunar space and do the asteroid retrieval crew mission and that kind of thing. But in so doing, we're going to do it with, even if we use SLS and Orion, which is the plan, we are taking, I think, more risk than Apollo did in landing, or at least flying to the moon or similar orbit, for two reasons. One, we don't have a redundant vehicle to do a self-rescue like Apollo 13. We don't have a lunar module. It's just the equivalent of the command service module out there. So everything, although it has redundant systems, those redundant systems can be brought out by a collision or something like that. And secondly, the capability of Orion is terribly mismatched with the Space Launch System. it's actually too small. And the Space Launch System is capable of putting a lot more mass into cislunar space, which would be really beneficial to enable any time return of the Orion. Right now, it gets into these, in the Asteroid Retrieval Crew mission, it gets into these two-week period orbits, during which much of that time they cannot initiate return to the Earth. So the Earth may be only 3 days away, but that's a cherry-picked best case. And it really worries me that, you know, in Apollo, on Apollo 8, which didn't have a lunar module, we had an opportunity every 3 hours to return to the Earth, initiate return to the Earth, which was only 3 days away in any of those cases. This is a little deeper. Even though we're actually higher altitude, we have less delta-V capability with Orion than we did in Apollo 8's command service module. So, yeah, we've got the money to get out there and take that first step in the proving ground, but it's pretty nasty. We also only have one launch pad. So if you're thinking about a ground-initiated rescue on a second pad, what I call launch on need, it's not in the cards because NASA's taken the other pad at Launch Complex 39 and leased it to SpaceX.
Right, and they're redeveloping
it. We have actually less rescue capability than we did back in 1968.
Anyone else want to comment? Jurist?
Well, I might want to broaden the discussion a little bit there, and that is there's been a lot of talk about the private sector could do this, and if they want to do it with their own money, that's fine and dandy. But most of the people that talk about some type of private sector space exploration are looking for ways to do it on other people's money. In other words, not accumulate the personal fortune and just fund it as an individual, but get other investors involved. And as soon as you do that, you've got fiduciary responsibilities to those other investors to spend their money wisely and hopefully provide a return. And that gets you back to the conundrum, David, that you've been talking about, the business case.
True. And I would also say there's a conundrum of how you disclose things, because I have talked to many, many well-meaning, extremely well-qualified, and very successful business people that have a business plan for doing something in space, whether it be mining asteroids or going to Mars or whatever. But when it comes to their disclosures on their space ventures, they're cherry-picked. And they're not cherry-picked to intentionally mislead. They're cherry-picked because of what we opened the show with. The longer you have been involved in doing all of this and not having oversight on you with someone like a Jurist or a Logan or an Adamo who forces you to run real numbers and make real assumptions and get yourself out of la-la land, the more likely you are to deceive yourself. And then you deceive others as well. So it's really easy to rip the assumptions to most of these plans apart. Because, and again, I don't think there's any misdoing here. I don't think there's any fraud here. I don't think there's any intentional, let's go screw people to get money. None of that is there. I think it goes back, as I said, to the first part of our program today, that the longer you get to hang out in fantasy land, without running real numbers and without having checks and balances coming from real people that are not in la-la land on you, the more likely it is that you can deceive yourself in your business ventures and your business plans. Now, you guys may disagree with me, or listeners may rip me a good one out there, but I think this is a real caveat in looking at space business plans. Is what is the oversight that is applicable to these business plans and to particularly these assumptions? And I think that's critical, especially if you're really seriously thinking about investing money. And I would say apply this to the suborbital companies. If you wanted to, and I know they take private capital, You know, they're all private companies, but they do private placements or investment capital. You really need that due diligence oversight because, you know, the companies can suck themselves in just like they can suck people in. And it's a real aphrodisiac, let me tell you. I don't know any. I mean, that's how I would answer you, John. Does anyone want to comment on that?
I tend to agree with you. I would also say, though, that some people might be willing to invest as sort of a lark in some type of space-related venture, and also with the hope that the principals who have formed the company will evolve into a more business-like attitude in the way they conduct their corporate affairs. Unfortunately, I think a better suited model for what many entrepreneurial space advocates want to do is more like a graduate school engineering departmental program than a true corporate model. We've talked about that in the past as well.
Jim or Dan, any comments on this line of thinking?
Dan has to agree with you. In fact, Dan will say that you have renewed my faith in humanity at several points when I've come to you with something that I know to be just ridiculous as a proposal and accusing the proposer of ill intent and that kind of thing, and you've come back to me and saying, no, they're just ignorant. And so I try and bide my displeasure with people misleading other people. Mislead doesn't imply intent to do so, intent to give incorrect impressions. Just sometimes that's the way it works out.
No, I don't think they're ignorant.
Dan, it's not always ignorance.
Yeah.
It's just delusional.
It's delusional.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true. That's what David's saying.
I always ask, you know, I talk to jurists a lot off the show. We're really good friends and we're in touch almost daily. And one of my questions is that he has a hard time answering. It's how can really, really smart people do A, B, C, or D, whatever it may be. It may be space-related, it may not be. And, you know, how do you define smart people? Okay, well, they're very successful in their business. They have college degrees. They're highly educated, da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, unless, and I can tell you this from my own experience, unless you have real oversight on what you're doing, it's like writing a book. You know, if you don't have proofreaders that will challenge you on the content of what you're saying, you could end up with a book that's just totally BS-oriented regardless of what the subject is. So sometimes the publisher will do content editing with you and compel you to go find the references for this, that, or the other to support it. But I think we all, and myself included, need, you know, oversight, you know, to keep us, you know, grounded in reality, whatever our field or discipline is. You know, in medicine, you know, I've talked many times on the show about my son with cystic fibrosis, and I have always taken medical facts and gone to doctors for second opinions, and 95% of my son's doctors have always welcomed that additional view. There are a couple of doctors who are real pricks, and, you know, if you go get a second opinion, you might as well stay with them and you don't need me anymore. You know, that kind of attitude. And, you know, that's a big red flag on its own. But most people doing things are genuinely and sincerely well-motivated and intended. And they will welcome real legitimate you know, over the shoulder looking, so to speak, and I just urge people to do that, to make use of that, because it's really easy to get sucked into your own stuff, and once that happens, who knows what the result will be? Guys, we have about 10 minutes left of our show today. So, what are the issues? I know Dan, you had before the show started, you had wanted to talk about some issues with SLS. Do we want to go there for this 10 minutes? Are there other things that we should have talked about and brought up that we have so far forgotten or omitted? Hello?
That would be number one on my list, but I'd be willing to defer to somebody else's agenda.
Jim, is there anything on your list of what we should have talked about that you still want to address during the show today? Did we lose Jim? You know, maybe we lost Jim. I don't know if he's still with us or not. John, what about you? I don't have an email from Jim. So. Go ahead, John.
I think the takeaways, from my point of view at least, are that the human factors issues, related life support issues, are very important. And at this point, we need to at least start addressing those issues before we get too involved in talking about a specific mission architecture for Mars, and or we have to deal with those issues in some fashion before starting to talk about a specific mission architecture. The other thing is, as a takeaway, I believe that there's a cogent argument for limiting ourselves to the Mars environment rather than the surface of Mars at this point in our thinking. And I would also argue that it makes sense as an intermediate step to go back to cislunar space, as we've discussed at length today.
Jim, are
as an initial step.
Jim, are you back with us?
Yeah, David. Sorry, I got kicked off, and I had to rejoin. Sorry about that.
Okay, so we're down to about a few minutes left. We haven't talked about SLS yet that Dan wanted to talk about. Is there anything we've omitted, or anything you want to make sure we cover before I turn it over to Dan on SLS?
No, I want to hear Dan talk about SLS.
Go for it, Dan. You've got about 8 minutes or so.
Okay, and since we are time limited, I won't really have a summary, but I think it's pretty evident from what we've all been saying. I certainly agree with John's summary. SLS is suffering from a sort of a two-stage imbalance between performance of a stage and the payload for that stage. And, of course, the first stage of SLS is the core stage, and it has to be burned to depletion, and when it depletes, it has to be in a orbit that automatically self-disposes. So, you know, it's sort of like the external tank on the shuttle. You burn it to depletion, and then it goes through apogee, has a slight positive flight path angle, so it's climbing, and then it goes through apogee, and then its perigee is back in the atmosphere, and it burns up and disposes without any action required. Hopefully in a safe area of the world, which it's designed to do. So the SLS first core stage has, in almost every one of its mission configurations, it has a perigee that's down deep in the atmosphere, just a few, maybe 10, 20 kilometers up. And when you put the first configuration for the SLS, you put the interim cryopropulsion stage as the second stage. This will be the configuration for its first flight, hopefully in 2017, 2018. Have effectively a stage it was never designed to operate with. The core stage overperforms with respect to the ICPS and drives apogee well over 1,000 kilometers in keeping the perigee low enough to dispose. And what you wind up with is a real loser in terms of getting to cislunar space, because that apogee is sort of geographically fixed, probably over the Indian Ocean or Australia or someplace like that. And that may not be the place you want to rendezvous with cislunar space. So it's only an efficient launch trajectory for transiting to translunar space or cislunar space on some days of the lunar month. So there's a movement at NASA, I think that's the current plan, is never to fly humans with the ICPS and move on to the exploration upper stage, the EUS, that the core stage was designed to operate with. And in that case, you wind up in a pretty much circular orbit with a small exploration upper stage burn after the core stage is depleted and put into its disposal orbit. And that stage is also suffering from an imbalance in performance because when you light it up to do translunar injection and go off to cislunar space, it can actually haul a lot more mass than just the Orion spacecraft. And NASA is advertising for co-manifested payloads on all these exploration missions out to cislunar space because it can send a lot more mass out there. And the sad thing about it is, why isn't that mass extra propellant for the Orion spacecraft so that it can initiate an abort from the asteroid retrieval crew mission orbit out there about 70,000 kilometers above the moon in a roughly two-week period? You could then hope to initiate an abort at any time. And so, you know, it's just imbalance after imbalance, and probably an excellent case in point of what happens when a legislative body designs your primary launch system for you without even really knowing the mission.
NASA is aware of it, and their solutions to work around it are what you're talking about, right?
Exactly. You know, in the ultimate state where, you know, the exploration upper stage launches an Orion towards cislunar space, you have what are called black zones when it arrives there. Black zones are periods of time where you can't initiate an abort to the Earth, or if you can initiate it, you aren't going very far toward getting back to Earth. You may be going into some kind of loiter interim orbit that doesn't get you to Earth, but sets up the ultimately getting there. And then you can also co-manifest payloads, so you aren't just putting ballast on the upper stage. You're doing something useful with that performance you didn't need to send Orion out to cislunar space. This is just, as a taxpayer, I'm a little disappointed, I guess. And it sure would be nice to see more performance on that Orion for cislunar missions.
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah. It's a flat budget, and no one can redesign anything. In effect, what we have is a vehicle that really, in its last incarnation, was supposed to be what you rode back to Earth from Mars in. And so it wasn't really supposed to be, you know, it wasn't supposed to have that much Delta V capability because all you needed to do was separate from the throwaway interplanetary transport and get yourself into the entry corridor for return to Earth, which probably will kill you because you've been under microgravity for months and suddenly you're going to hit the atmosphere and pull 8 or 10 Gs. That's another, you know, ought to be a calculated risk, but we have no data, so I can't call it a calculated risk. I call it a blind risk. Going in blind. Hopefully you crew can survive.
Well, again, since we don't have these capabilities, we may likely not test these issues for a long, long time.
I just hope we do test it somehow in a reasonably controlled fashion, incrementally increasing it or coming up with a mitigation procedure so that people don't have to are in shape to undergo such a stress to the cardiovascular system.
Okay, gentlemen, does anyone else have any comments or final thoughts? Hello, anyone there? John, do you?
I'm done.
Jim?
Yeah, no, I don't have any other comments to make. I think it's been a good show. I've learned a lot from Dan.
We always learn a lot from all three of you.
For the forum. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, until the next time, gentlemen, and I want to thank you very much. And there were a couple of emails that I did not get to. One gentleman, Gord, we sort of indirectly answered his questions because he was talking about 10% cost overruns, the NASA budget, and developing technologies and hardwares and stuff like that. He said the solution is to develop our in-space economy. So that's what the cislunar development is all about. So we answered his question on an indirect method, and I did want to put that out. Well, we'll reconvene and see where we are a year or so down the road, and see how the situation looks then. Maybe somebody will come up with business cases for going to Mars or something like that, even for the public sector. And we'll see what happens on that. But I want to thank each of you for your time and for joining us today, and for you, the listeners, and for those of you who participated in our show. And make sure you listen to the archives, post comments or questions if you have on it. And everybody have a great weekend coming up. Thanksgiving is just around the corner. To our three guests, I certainly wish each and every one of you a great Thanksgiving with you and your family, and for all of you as well. We have two shows next week before Thanksgiving, Monday and Tuesday, and then we do open lines after the Thanksgiving holiday on Sunday. Everybody, again, have a great weekend coming up. Goodbye from the Space Show.